perfect picture painted by ancient artists.
Welcome back to Creative Dialogue with me, Joe Stevens. Today we have the remainder of my conversations with Alan Rogers, recorded at Weymouth Pavilion a few weeks ago.
So you've got quite a limited budget,
yeah,
and it's a thing about balancing, yeah, employing local people against bringing in a large audience.
Yeah, and I think if you took a straw poll across, say, some of the amateur artists or people who've got two jobs and one of them is an artistic job here, which is quite a common scenario. There's also quite a lot of artists here who are of an older generation and retired and do it for a hobby and or do it for pleasure or, you know, all the rest of it. I think if you took a straw poll across them, they might come back with a different answer to that. I think that they might feel as the Olympics are coming and they haven't been involved, you know. And it's quite interesting that from the very start of this Olympic journey, there's been a kind of presumption from the organising committee of the Olympic Games that everyone would want to immediately buy in and put their hand up and volunteer. And actually that's not the case. And so there's quite a lot of my work is done building that bridge between local community and, you know, projects that are coming in from the outside. And part of me thinks that actually people who are here and working here also need to raise their game. And there's been, I think there's a slight resistance to that.
They just expect to have a bit of that money they see coming in.
Yeah.
As an expectation.
Yeah, here. That's it. And there is a question you've got down there. I think it's towards the end.
Is it desirable?
Yes, yeah, okay.
Is it desirable and realistic nowadays for artists to aspire to a full-time artist?
Because as a person coming in from Italy or from working in America or India, or, you know, that's my background, you know, when I got to Britain, one of the things we were talking about was that difference in culture. If you're an artist in Italy, I would guarantee you're probably a waiter. You know, people make money doing other things and do great art, actually, you know, really good contemporary art, which is not supported by any institution. And there's no dole, there's no social security network. So you have to be realistic about what it is you can do, how much you can sacrifice, where your time and energy lies, etc., etc. And there's just no doubt in my mind that we are the society in the world that supports artists more than anybody else. And I think that has backfired, and I think there's a reliance
on handouts and grants.
And I think that an expectation from an artist who thinks, oh, the Olympics have got, you know, millions of pounds, I want some of that, is actually a really unrealistic expectation.
As they're finding out.
And it was never going to happen that way. I think some of that reliance on aid, it fuels that in some way.
Which and comes back to the Enterprise and Art scheme in a way, and that birth of...
It does, isn't it? It's very interesting. You know, if you're a socialist, and you pretend to be a socialist, then you look back on some of those conservative kind of initiatives and think, actually, that did more for socialism than socialism did.
I don't actually think it did, but I did think it ingrained in artists the idea that they were a self-employed enterprise of keeping books.
The difficulty with it, I think, Joe, is that you can't square that with, I want to do exactly what I want to do. You know, you do come to that point in a business.
But part of that Enterprise Announce, you had to come up with a business plan and bookkeeping. So that idea of projecting a profit and a few loss, that was all ingrained in you in a way before you...
Ingrained in you until you got to the point 6 years down the line when the accountant said to you, you know, so what's happening with those 15,000 paintings you've got stored in your room? You know, how do we write that off? You're not going to show them, you're not going
to
do it.
They gave it to you for a year, the Enterprise Allowance.
They did, but I think actually a lot of people stayed self-employed at that point.
Yeah, but then they weren't so much getting them.
No, they weren't getting the money, but they
had to survive.
But what I think the point is that if you start a business in anything, there comes to the point when you have to look at the market, who your audience or your clients are, and it's a compromise between what you do, what you really want to do as an artist, and what actually is going to make you the money to do it. And I think public artists toe that line, if they're good, you know, they toe that line of being able to express themselves.
Well, it's a collaboration, isn't it? Like you were saying, so it's a balance between the public, the group they're working with, and themselves as an artist.
It is, but the one thing that sits badly with the artist in that conversation is mediocrity, I think, in that actually the big corporate who wants to do the commission for the stained glass atrium isn't interested in pushing the boundaries. They want, in general, to have something great but safe, and something that's based on something else that they've seen. And I think that sits not well with artists who want to just try and experiment or push the boundaries or actually do what it is that they want to do. You know, there's that compromise bit. Some people manage it, some people don't. But that whole thing about understanding, say, why the Arts Council would grant aid a project and why they haven't grant aided me has to be looked at with a kind of objectivity of saying, yeah, okay, my work isn't that good. I do need to go and learn about this or that. I am open to learning. You know, I've come across many artists who are not, who have reached a certain point in their career and said, well, I know what I do and the rest of the world doesn't understand me, and I get left out. So it's that kind of opt-in, opt-out.
Which is quite interesting about the amateur as an artist, which I've got quite buying into the idea of an amateur, because they're doing it out of love.
Absolutely
of
right.
What they do.
Absolutely right.
And I've got a big love of that idea that, like I say, people of various ages here are now producing things.
Yeah, yeah. And you could say that about the situation in Italy or Spain or any of the countries where contemporary art's not so funded as it is here. Is that if after being a waiter for 5 years you're still producing and you're still producing and you're still pushing and you're still doing it, you've got that love and you've got that passion inside you to see it through. And I think if we threw all the supported artists in Britain over into that situation, many would fall by the wayside on the way, if you like. Oh, they would stop their practice.
Or they would make hard decisions about their practice and change.
Exactly. And you know, coming back to me as a person, you know, I'm frustrated as hell at the moment. My job is all-consuming. I can't practice.
No.
In a way, I've always had periods when I haven't practiced, knowing that I would need to practice full-time. You know, I'm not the kind of person who can do a Thursday morning. I need to practice totally, or set aside a period of time and say, no, this is not about that, this is about something else. So that's quite interesting, like, how you deal with that. But I think amateur artists is really, it's a really interesting thing. It's people just do it because they love to do it. And when they love to do it, you can't have the same critical faculty applied to it either. You know, if someone wants to go and paint a landscape because they love the landscape and they love painting, you can't apply a kind of critique to that.
Well, I think you can. I don't think there's a critique when there's a change of it. Your understanding on the basis of the work might change, but I don't think your critique of the actual piece.
Would that change? I'd feel less inclined to critique a piece like that and more inclined to encourage the person to continue doing it.
Oh, yeah, I'd want to. But in a critique of something that was publicly funded, you still would want to encourage that. It's the idea of, like, coming back to being a teacher, really, that idea of creative criticism of encouraging the person, but also...
Yeah.
Yeah, which is very difficult, spotting out what's wrong with their work, and there's something to
and how to encourage
to progress
and that's also about, you know,
and I think that's very important. That's the trouble of amateur art in a way, is that that's missing the thing we've got at universities, and interesting, it was brought up at with Julia PBA with the lab culture, that idea of lab culture is part of criticism, what happened within the group, and also at the end of the process, and that, and generally is quite missing.
That's true.
Got quite interested in this discussion about this space. So there is public funding for art available in this country, which is being cut back like everything else. And it's whether, like, the Arts Council should we just cut the Arts Council and put all that money into the NHS and housing, which are much needed. Is there a value in us subsidising?
Yes, there is a value in that. That's my opinion. There is, you know, at the very, if you strip all that away and strip the layers of complication away, you know, one of the things that separates us from the animals is creativity, and creativity is in every single genetic cell that we occupy, you know. And
but without health and housing,
without health, I mean, which is the more fundamental? It's like the question of, you know, what would you do if the world was blown up? You know, procreate or preserve the knowledge of man? You know, that kind of a situation. But they fundamentally coexist, because to build a shelter, you need the imagination to build the shelter. You know, understanding the context, how the rain and the snow is going to fall, etc. And that becomes architecture very quickly. And it becomes, you know, vernacular architecture very, very quickly. I just think creativity is so embedded in actually everything. It's a process in life that creativity is either kicked out of us or compromised out of us, or we decide to leave that part to somebody else, you know. But actually it's fundamentally there. So
but I would not... Coming on to this idea that, like say, Italy and Spain don't fund the arts as much as we do, should then art, should we just say, well, if your art is successful, you're going to earn a living from it, but we're going to take the public funding that we get into other areas?
If you look at, I mean, it's not that Italy don't publicly fund, it's the fact that, you know, there always is a particular budget for arts, culture, creativity within any government. It's usually quite a low proportion compared with other areas. And in cases like Italy, they choose to preserve the Vatican, the Colosseum, and, you know, the Michelangelos, the Leonardos, which are all funded either through the church or private enterprise, you know. But that's where 96%, I think, of the Ministry of Culture's money goes. Into the kind of, you know, it's a decision with a lot of nous. Italy knows that that's what it trades on, and that's why people go to Italy to see those things, and they spend money when they're there, you know. It has probably a proportionately higher amount of money put into eco-farming, viticulture, wine industry, and the quality of its food industry, which is just, you know, compared with Britain, it's massively higher. And that's seen as culture as well. Whilst contemporary art of a certain kind is less funded, I think culture in general, if you take it on the round, is funded. I mean, it was quite interesting that in the Arts Council seminar recently, which was for new national portfolio organisations, you know, they were asking the question, if we're going to take a 50% cut in our operating costs in the next few years, which they are, where would you cut it? And actually, the feeling from the floor was, cut the glass towers and keep the people. Get out the palaces. Make people more mobile. Use the connectivity that we've got, but don't lose people, because the people hold the knowledge of the institution really more than anything. And therefore, there are lots of new ways you can work, which are part public funded and part private funded, or they're philanthropically funded. I mean, philanthropic giving is a kind of... I find that a very interesting question, that the Arts Council themselves recognising that there will be less money, trying to explore avenues and encourage arts organisations to either make a relationship with businesses or with philanthropy. And having worked in America and seen how that works, really works, you've got to question whether the British public have that philanthropic attitude towards the arts that other countries have. That's a kind of very interesting thing. Is it within our DNA? And then there are some strange economics at work at the moment, not just the kind of global situation, but the, you know, the fact that in an economic slump there will be very shortly more money in the grants for the arts than was ever predicted, because people are buying lottery tickets because they're desperate. No, this is true. And if you think that, you know, a proportion of a lottery ticket goes to sport and art, and that's divided between sport and art, yeah, nationally and then regionally. For the Arts Councils to say, actually, there's a bit more money in the pot than we thought was going to. It's whether you sit back and you say, actually, you know, I know who I am and I'm not going to reinvent myself, or actually I'm going to push the boundary and try and seize the opportunity. So,
what effect do you think then the Cultural Olympiad will have on this region? Because your job finishes in September?
Yeah, it does. It finishes in September 2012.
I don't see the council renewing that post.
The council never invented the post. The post is kind of funded by a partnership of Arts Council, Weymouth College, Dorset County Council. Weymouth and Portland Borough Council put a little towards it. And so to have a council-funded post in this economic situation where, you know, 100,000 workers have gone from local authorities seems unlikely. And yet, the case that's been made for the economic benefit alone, or the benefit to tourism through culture, has been made, I think. And I've seen a big change in, especially in elected councillors, repositioning the value of culture within, if you like, the pecking order of things, you know.
And we're talking about where, how the money gets divided.
Exactly. So I've seen a real change and a realisation and a few green lights going on in people's minds, which is great news. But that kind of work, it requires longevity and it requires sustaining, because someone has to be there putting the case for culture all the time, or else it will be forgotten, you know, in people's minds. But as it goes up the ladder, it becomes important in the tourism and economy, particularly, sort of strand of work, that culture features very highly in that. And I think the realisation that, you know, watching the triangles out there 4 miles out in the bay is not fundamentally not going to be that interesting, but what's happening in the cultural programme will be. So, you know, people coming for the Olympic experience are more likely to encounter a cultural experience than actually a sporting experience. So I've seen that kind of go up the agenda. If one thing could come out of 2012, it would be to continue making that agenda happen, making that the awareness of what culture brings, that would be a great legacy.
It would be.
And
but that's a possibility at the moment, because you've got about, what, so we've got a year left in your position.
It's a question that I'm beginning to bring to various people in teams and committees and say, have you thought, you know, because everyone is quite understandably so focused on delivering a good games, a good 2012, a good experience for people, you know, because there is that part of 2012 which is about showcasing the best of the Southwest and actually inspiring people and saying, wow, we could do that, or we could get involved in that. So those are two a little bit very measurable, those two legacies. You can't sort of apply the rules of economic spend to them. It's what is left in people's minds. And if you think of your own experience, or I think of mine, those moments when something, you've seen something and you've gone, wow, that's really interesting and I really want to get involved with that. You know, and they are salient moments. You've got to create those moments and make them happen. So hopefully somewhere in that programme of events next year, there are those sparky points for people where they can just go, I never realised a wheelchair could fly underwater. They're very hard to monitor and they're very hard to predict, because obviously they're different for different people. So you have to put a broad range of stuff out there and do that. There is, you know, the danger, and I recognise it, there is the danger that, you know, once the public funding stops, and it will, that you're left with a black hole. And you have to guard against that by putting things in place now. In a way, there will be a black hole if there's no one left to actually say, actually, that's an inspiration, we could do that, or we could do this, or, you know, the pavilion should be going this way or that way, or, you know.
It's a good answer, really, because you're saying on one hand it's just like, say, the spark of the imagination that it might, a piece of work that's happening over the Cultural Olympiad might spark, which is unpredictable, and the practical level of councillors having a slight. Yeah, again, because I'm thinking, like I say, I'm thinking of how you cut up a small cake that's getting smaller, and that culture is slightly creeping up.
Yeah, it is, and for the people who, like the councillors who are unelected and may not have known much about culture, the first argument is, okay, if you put £15,000 on the beach, they spend this much money. You know, that's the first argument you put. But beyond that, there's many more arguments. Actually, if you put a really quality, you know, and a spectacle of quality on the beach, it does much more than that. It's not just about spending your £15 or your £30. It's actually about getting a reputation for the place. Things are happening, things of quality are happening, and people do recognise quality when they see it. They definitely do.
In long-term benefits, which are hard, I suppose, hard to predict what we'll bring in. We've been quite a bit of time, but so there's one question I am very interested in, being a part-time artist myself, is how artists' precarious career.
Yeah, very precarious career.
What advice would you give to enable sustainability in an artist's practice? Have you got any
advice.
Tips and advice on how people, artists, up their game, it's possibly one.
Up their game. Looking at your own work critically and being able to kind of say, actually, I need to strengthen those areas, and do that in a spirit of, it's good to learn, always, it's good to learn. And what's worked for me particularly is to capitalise on a few different strengths and not be afraid to move laterally and say, actually, just because I'm working as a teacher in a secondary school does not mean to say I compromise the creativity or the quality of the art. You know, I'm just shifting the focus over here, and it's earning me some money. So I suppose to have more than one string to your bow would be something that's worked for me. To try and just keep challenging yourself, I suppose, in a way, and just keep fluid and keep moving and keep thinking and.
Because that idea of challenging myself, I suppose, is quite hard, because I do see Weymouth as a bit of a vacuum. I have been interested in my looking for people to interview, that they seem to have quite a lot of disparate groups that don't seem to talk to each other.
Well, I mean, I suppose one thing that I've encouraged is for at least one of those groups to get together and form themselves into a community interest company,
which is
Artway. They can also see the disadvantages of formalising themselves, you know, because there are many amateur artists within that group, and there are semi-professional artists, and it's a bit of a mixture. They sort of see, well, like, occasionally the question comes up in the meeting, like, why are we still a CIC?
Okay.
What's the benefit for us? You know, the thing that motivates, and which I also put into the conversation as a motivator, is that, you know, 3 years ago, as a CIC, you were eligible for lots more grants. Because you're a formally constituted organisation, as opposed to, you know, that.
Well, surely just being a formally constituted group would have put you forward to a lot of grants.
It does, but what I'm finding is, you know, after 2 or 3 years down the line of that, is actually what's happened is that people are talking to each other, at least within the group, which is quite a big group, you know, members. And for the first time with 2012 there, it's kind of instigated a project, which is led by someone within the group, but it's actually it's a collaborative project, and they're making a kind of a big tapestry of local heroes in Appliqué, and various members are contributing either by volunteering or running the sessions, or, you know, this is an ongoing project over 10 months, starting with a big draw, and I think that was a nice and surprising and human kind of thing to come out of that formation of the CIC, is that there is genuinely more togetherness and more.
But do you think that's because it's a CIC or just because they're a constituted group?
I
don't see the difference.
I think, well, any constituted group would have done it.
Yeah.
It's just that one fit, the model fitted more appropriately than a charity or a limited company. But there is something about the formalisation of the group which actually has worked very much in terms of how they now talk and collaborate with each other on various enterprises that they do. I think that's a really human thing. There's always a danger with an unconstituted group that things fall apart. And there's another way of looking at it, is that just being aware of actually the cost of what you do and the consequences and the capacity and the time of doing this actually brings a sort of self-realization that this, you know, you are interested in this, you do want to do it, you do want to make it happen. And rather than kind of burying your head in the sand and just paying for things out of your pocket and finding things very haphazardly, there's a kind of group ethos that you can work with.
And it is a business, and it's profit and loss and that.
Yeah. You know, in my own work, it's like there are sometimes when Alan, the person, and Alan, the cultural coordinator, are not in any way divorced at all. You do separate it. I think people do have a tendency to separate if you're what's called a public servant. That's a very interesting phrase that some person who was irate about something once said to me. You know, but you're a public servant, and I went, I'm not. And then I went away and thought about it, and thought about the fact that, you know, if you work for a local authority, then there is the line which has been decided by policy and democratic process, and you will tell it. And then you get, you know, the internal bitchiness against it from people who don't actually believe that the line that they're towing. And I have less difficulty with that because I operate independently, so those two things are not often divorced, but they can be divorced at certain times because you need to tow a political line and be in agreeance with things.
Yeah, so you are a public servant, but I suppose that's it. You haven't gone in as a career structure, like a lot of other civil servants. It's a different type of position that you hold.
And also the projects that I've been involved with are, some have been decided by democratic process and some are not. So, you know, and some are definitely top down and some are definitely bottom up. So there's a whole mixture of stuff in there to try and assimilate.
So if anybody wants to find out more about you and your job and your position, do you have a particular website or means of contact?
There will be a Cultural Olympiad website for the Maritime Mix, which is the name that we've decided we're going to call the Cultural Olympiad by the Sea here. Right. It should be up online in January.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you very much.
Thank you to listening to Creative Dialogue with me, Joe Stevens. Thanks for the time Alan gave me in recording this interview. I found it most illuminating. If you'd like to find out more about, you can go to the website creativedialogue.wordpress.com. You can also listen to an interview I did with Martin Franklin for the Gene Pool show, which I will put a link up to on the website, where I talk a bit about this show and the ideas that have led up to it. Hope you enjoyed it. Please do get in contact with any feedback. Hope you join us next week. Bye for now.